I do believe that this public-private interface is sort of an opportunity for effectiveness and efficiency across health, energy, education, financial services, and the like. So I'm passionate. And let's get healthcare right, Nico. Let's work together to make this better. And who knows what the future holds.
Welcome to the Redox Podcast. I'm your host, Nico Skivaski, co-founder and president of Redox, where we are on a mission to make healthcare data useful and in turn enable the frictionless adoption of technology in healthcare. The Redox Podcast explores the intersection between healthcare and technology. How is tech making a difference? What are the barriers to adoption, and how are they being overcome? We talk to some of our industry's brightest minds, up-and-coming technologists, and health tech legends that have paved the way for what's to come. One thing is certain, healthcare will change dramatically over the coming years. My hope is that you'll leave these conversations with a bit more context, along with a jolt of optimism to continue working for a better healthcare. With that in mind, I welcome you to the Redox Podcast. Anish Chopra is the co-founder and president of Care Journey, a healthcare analytics company based in Arlington, Virginia. In addition to his work at Care Journey, Anish is an author, having published the book Innovative State: How Technologies Can Transform Government. And he's a dedicated public servant. He was Secretary of Technology for the state of Virginia and then named as the first Chief Technology Officer of the United States, appointed by President Barack Obama. After his 3 years as CTO, Obama said that Anish's legacy of leadership and innovation will benefit Americans for years to come. I think once again, Obama was right in that statement, because Anish has definitely stayed on this path of helping to be a proactive advocate for the initiatives that the government is pushing, as well as where we should be as an industry and how we're working towards that. So Anish, thank you for joining us on the Redox Podcast today.
And Nico, thank you for having me. I'm a fan of what you're doing and excited for our discussion.
So to start off with, when President Obama appointed you as the nation's first CTO, the official announcement stated that the CTO would promote technology innovation to help the country meet a number of goals, from technology creation and job creation to homeland protection and to reduce healthcare costs. So, of course, you were behind a number of the industry-changing initiatives from the healthcare perspective. It's been about 10 years now. Tell us about some of the initiatives that you were behind and how they progressed. And, you know, are you pleased with how they've progressed over the past decade?
Yeah, thank you for all of that. To give you some context, we were in the midst of the economic recession, and the number one priority for anyone on the team was to find ways that we could put Americans back to work. But the president had kind of a longer term vision. When we actually wrote the legislation for what we now call the Recovery Act, its formal title was the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And so the latter statement spoke to where we put a lot of our chips on the table as it relates to investments as building blocks for this, hopefully, a better, more inclusive, more productive economy. Now, that vision in healthcare had three foundational points, and I'll walk you through some of the history and obviously give you the grade on where I think we are. First and foremost, we felt that the government should play a role in this area, specifically around the release of health information that was already in the hands of the government, but may not have been accessible to the public, and certainly not in a friendly manner or an easy to access manner. You know, a few researchers that get access to something doesn't necessarily equate to democratizing knowledge and insight. So the first pillar was to make sure that we opened up the data held by the government to make all regulated sectors better: health, energy, education, et cetera. The second, and I think this gets to this issue of the investments we've made, there was bipartisan interest in jumpstarting a move to electronic health records. There'd been a lot of discussion about it. The Recovery Act created a window of opportunity. Now, like in Goldilocks, some might say we spent too much and asked too little. Others might say that we didn't focus on the right priorities. But the goal at the time was to put people back to work, which meant money flowing through the economy in advance of really the kind of fundamental changes that are needed. You can't just flip the switch and say, hey, we're going to go from legacy enterprise software to internet-based, cloud-based, ubiquitous connectivity. And so we acknowledged on the front end that we would want to put ourselves in a position to say, we're going to ratchet up the requirements as the industry could handle it. And that while we would be ratcheting up the requirements, we'd be paying for a lot of it up front. And there was a little bit of a faith that we would be able to continue to influence the industry, even though the incremental dollars would be slowing down in terms of the incentives. That part, for me, was really about kind of an R&D goal to get us to the next generation of healthcare infrastructure. And so we reserved a little bit of money, Nico, about $60 million in research and development activities focused on the electronic health records that could be internet-based as opposed to maybe legacy enterprise software-based. And that resulted in a small grant to a team at Harvard, about a $15 million grant to the legendary Ken Mandel and Zach Cohen, which really became the backbone of what we now call Smart on Fire. There wasn't really a consensus around fire at the time, but the grant said, let's look at the internet economy and how we can bring it to healthcare. And so anyway, we'll get back to that in a moment, but that was the second pillar, really to help shepherd some of that R&D work while we were doing the day-to-day of meaningful use under the leadership of David Blumenthal and Farzad and the team at HHS. Last but not least, I had a bit of a bottom-up change theory that the president was promoting and the use of technology to reach the expertise of the country as opposed to concentrating on experts in Washington. And so we thought, let's run the model of sort of crowdsourcing and surface the best ideas that could come from doctors, hospitals, networks all across the country. We put up a $1 billion healthcare innovation challenge. And that challenge was focused on, are there interventions that could be deployed on a specific cohort of patients that, absent what they do today, would lead to better care at lower cost? And those were the three pillars. So if you said to me, Anish, what was the role of the CTO and how do we think about this sort of change agenda in healthcare? It really centered around these three enabling ingredients, the release of data, the investments in internet-based interoperability standards, and the thought process around the bottom-up change agents. And obviously, Nico, it goes without saying, the underbelly of all of this was the Affordable Care Act, which became the economic model to scale and surface all of these ideas.
I think something that was really interesting about the way that this came about, I guess in 2012, I read that you told The Atlantic that the country's health IT strategy was an example of how ideas from the tech community were effectively being incorporated into the shaping of government policy. Talk to us a bit about how the policy was shaped by what was going on kind of in the private sector and the innovations that came, you know, probably from other industries as well, and how that was planned to be brought into healthcare.
Yeah, so there were three things that were happening in parallel. First and foremost, the entire country, frankly, the global IT infrastructure was undergoing a sea change towards cloud computing. So during the transition team, before I served as CTO, while I was still in Virginia in government, we experimented with the role of cloud computing in the public sector. That is to say, there were a number of private sector initiatives that were taking advantage of cloud computing, and it was better, faster, cheaper, and in many cases, a platform for innovation. So we adopted the CIO, my friend and colleague, Vivek Kundra, who had responsibility for sort of government IT. We sort of partnered up and asked the question, how do we bring that capability, not just into the operations of government, which Vivek did through a program called Cloud First, where we directed every federal agency to start going down the road of cloud computing, but to think about that in our regulatory regime, in our public-private partnership models, which was more my domain. So there was a kind of a horizontal concept across all industries, which was the move to cloud. Okay, so that was principle number one, and that was, in my view, a big wave of my focus around why subsidizing enterprise technology to get the adoption up in healthcare IT was insufficient. We had to have a strategy for cloud. Point two, there's a really interesting market failure in healthcare, which is the uniqueness of the American model of standards development is all about the private sector self-organizing, reaching consensus, and having the US government scale that consensus standard. In contrast, Nico would say China, where the government might say, you know what? We're going to dictate that the Wi-Fi standard for the country is X, and it may be slightly different than the global Wi-Fi standard. And if you want to do business in China, you got to conform to X. So think of the energy sector. We put $10 billion into modernizing what you would call the smart grid, smart meter infrastructure. So instead of those analog meters in your home, now there's digital meters that can record your consumption patterns, distribute that information to the utility, allow for more rapid response. In the energy sector, we had very little need for the equivalent of an ONC. We created a table and GE, Pepco, Vendor X, Vendor Y, all came together and put a roadmap led by the private sector to say, if I bought an electric vehicle in Colorado and I drive to my mother's home in Florida, but I want to charge it in my mother's garage, the system should be able to know that it's me, my car, and that the bill should go to my address in Colorado. In contrast with the fear that maybe the utility company in Florida might have a different plug that wouldn't be compatible with my, you know, electric vehicle from manufacturer Z. And so this fear of information blocking or the lack of standardization was there's no such thing as information blocking in the utility sector. We had a model where the industry self-organized. And I'll just tell you one little anecdote, Nico, before I give you my third example. But this one little anecdote was, I remember specifically talking to the CIO of Pacific Gas and Electric. I was asking her about what it would take to provide access to her customers' utility information to an application of their choice. That is to say, if I wanted to see my utility readings myself, as opposed to just having the utility company get it, how easy could I do that? And we brainstormed. And one of the questions that I asked is, at the time, the German company SAP had something like an 85% market share for the utility data across the country. They're essentially the industry monopolist. I said, you know, Karen, just give me a little bit of context here. Do you need permission from SAP? Is there some intellectual property issues? Is there like, can you show me your screenshots? I'm making a joke here. We didn't really talk about that, but just I'm giving the analogy. She laughed so hard. She said, are you kidding me? They are my vendor. I control the data. I control the infrastructure. I have decision-making authority of what we choose to do or not do. And Nico, in less than 90 days, she was able to convince her colleagues in Southern California and in Central California to jointly announce that within 90 days, they would advance the technical standards that would allow consumer apps to get access to the utility meter data, all protected like PHI, you know, and again, with no vendor like permissioning, okay? Complete led by the industry. So point number two was that this consensus standards, let's make this happen. It's good to make the market economy work, lower barriers to entry, promote competition, support innovation. For whatever reason, that's not the culture we have in healthcare. Okay, I'll get more on that as we get into the weeds of where we are today. But final statement, once we've, you know, understood the presence and the promise and potential of cloud, and we saw how standards consensus bodies worked in other sectors, the last leg for me was that across all regulated industries, there seems to be some consistency that the consumer has the right to their data. In the utility sector, it's states that regulate this right, and it's happening in a growing number of states even to this day. In Dodd-Frank, the banking regulation, we made a clear statement that consumers have the right to access their financial data from any checking account to any app of their choice. And in FERPA, which is the educational version of HIPAA, there's a similar right that individuals have the parents and kids have the right to their educational data. So when you look at across the industry, Nico, this principle of consumer-directed exchange has been the bedrock of law. It just hadn't quite connected to the technical standards and regulatory roadmap. So while I have a right to some of these things, when I actually show up with an app, it's not obvious to me how it's supposed to interact with the people that have the data in the first place. So those were three areas that I felt external industry feedback to what we're doing in healthcare needs a boost.
I think that's fascinating. And in on your book, The Innovative State, Clayton Christensen, the author of Innovator's Dilemma, wrote that healthcare is an industry where market forces don't naturally foster innovation. So that suggests that maybe we need policy to help push healthcare towards that direction, something that we didn't see You know, the same thing happened as compared to the financial industry or the energy industry. So what is it about healthcare that makes it so they didn't organize themselves? And why did we need the government to step in there?
Yeah, so it's an interesting scenario in that in all of those examples, there actually are government regulations, but the intensity and the need have changed. So let me just take that back a little bit. First, let me describe the banking sector so you know the context for the audience. In the Dodd-Frank legislation, we added a provision that said the consumer has the right to access their data and to connect it to an app of their choice. And that is specifically referencing checking accounts and your bank accounts. Now, that provision gave legal authority to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to issue regulations, the equivalent of an ONC meaningful use rule. That legislation went into effect 2010 or so. How many rules do you think the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has written in order to meet this requirement?
Ooh, if this was healthcare, it'd be many. But in our financial friends, did they self-regulate? Were they able to do this on their own?
Zero. The answer is zero. Dodd-Frank created the legal authority and said, look, if you don't get your act together, we'll do this. But the benefit of all this is that the industry caught, got the message and did self-organize. In fact, they have their own equivalent of the FHIR API called the OFX API, and it is very similar in structure. Consumer uses an app, they use OAuth, they approve the app, and they go through a series of steps with communication, and the information flows. And by the way, Jamie Dimon explicitly stated in one of his reports many years ago that, I think it was a letter to shareholders, that with the cybersecurity threat, the standards at the time of Mint.com and so forth were really screen scraping technologies where, Nico, you and I would enter our username and password. They would store that on a web application like a Mint.com. They would then log in as if we were humans to pull the data. And as you know, that's a cybersecurity risk because how does the data holder, the bank that's regulated to keep that information safe, know that it's really Nico and not a fake Nico? So the standards development to get to that level of security was really driven by industry consensus. In fact, when Jamie Dimon explained and expressed his frustration with screen scraping, he got a call from the regulator, and the regulator said, are you going to handle this on your own? And Jamie said, we'll get it done. And 90 days later, we have a technical consensus standard that's scaling across the industry. This is a sidebar. Now in healthcare, we have a number of problems that are confounding this issue. And let's say at the outset, technology is not one of them. The technical ability to connect an app from a consumer or a doctor to a sort of a system of record is widely deployed in production across almost every internet asset in the global economy. APIs really are the foundation of interoperability, and there's no technical debate. The issue is one of priorities and customers. It's easy to blame EHR vendors to say, well, this is a vendor issue and there's sort of information blocking and it's sort of a competitiveness issue. I actually am not a fan of that type of attack. I appreciate the sentiment, but it really is a microcosm of the healthcare economy writ large. We have a uniquely private sector-led healthcare economy as opposed to the rest of the world where it's mostly government organized or there's much more regulation. So in that scenario, if you're selling software to a customer, you respond to that customer's requirements. And I would argue the root cause of where we are today is that customers who are buying the EHR software are not prioritizing the need for, basically consensus industry standards to facilitate this. Now, some cynics might say it's because the data shows if you're one integrated system and a patient is coming to you for one service, that the fact that you've got all their data means that they're going to more frequently rely on you and maybe not seek a consult outside of the network. And so there is an economic argument that says, our system since our systemness is an advantage and it leads to revenue growth or market share. That is likely the case. And so if you are an EHR vendor and you sell to products to a customer, it's hard to not do what they're asking you to do. So that's my general view, is that we have a market failure on the demand signal for interoperability standards. That's where the governments come in.
Well, so real quick, before we dive into where the governments come in, I think this is an important point, because EHR vendors get thrown under the bus every day around them not producing the functionality required to share these data. And, you know, from my experience at Epic, I was there for a number of years during the meaningful use era, and Epic had such devotion to doing what their customers asked. I think that's one of the most customer-focused companies that certainly I've ever worked for, but you know, a great example in the industry of, you know, they loved working with their customers and meeting their needs. And I think you're 100% right. The customers are not demanding that as a functionality that they provide. It's, you know, it's almost like they see data as an asset that they can take advantage of to make their company stronger, right? It's like asking Walmart and Target to share their data with each other. It's like, no, this is our customers' data. We're going to use it to treat our patients better, and therefore our patients will stay with us longer. And therefore, interoperability kind of wasn't a very high priority. Would you agree with that characterization, or was I kind of taking it too far there?
Let me make, I always sort of make statements in threes. One, I share your view that generally my philosophy is sort of love everybody. Like, everyone's doing a job. They're doing the best they can. There's not a lot of nefariousness going on. And if there is, it's sort of second and third order nefariousness as opposed to primary. Point one, we're generally responding to market incentives. Point number two, there's no monolithic demand signal. The organizations that are buying IT, what's their number one goal? Uptime. What's their number two goal? Physician burden or sort of workflow. What's their number three goal? Efficiency. You know, is the use case going to make us more efficient than when we were on paper? When you go through those lists, you know, being able to easily exchange information with the competitor health system or my health plan that's beating me up on rates, that doesn't go to the one, two, or three. That's probably a four, or five, or a six. Now, no organization's a monolith. So the health systems have many people that have interest in these things. And I would argue any one health system that you could point to and say, hey, they don't demand this, have leaders on their teams that reflect the demand. So it's not to say that there's zero demand at XYZ health system for interoperability. It's that somehow in the negotiation about projects and priorities, it doesn't make the top cut. But then there's a third feature. And that third feature here is that we are undergoing a fundamental change in the market. And that's really the Affordable Care Act and the whole move to value-based care, which is rewarding collaboration. So it's not Target v. Walmart, and somehow miraculously they're going to play well together. This is the analogy of Target v. Walmart in a market that has, you know, incentivizes Target to make sure the customers get the lowest cost goods that they want, whether they shop at Walmart or Target. And if they can, you know, lower the overall cost while, you know, maintaining their annual budget, then they'll be rewarded. The fundamental change in the economy, we're in this bizarre period where that incentive is growing. It hasn't yet scaled to the point where it's the dominant driver, back to the point about market signal, but it is coming. You look at this phenomenon, and the best you can imagine is, if there was a way we had clear voice about where we're heading and could derive the system to prepare for that future, then that naturally says that's a role for government. We've got to do this. These requirements are not in demand today, but when we move to value-based care, they will be needed. And if we haven't made the investment now, by the time we actually demand it, it'll be another decade of infrastructure improvement. So we can't wait. We can't do this thing in sequence. We got to go in parallel.
Gotcha. So the movement towards value-based care is going to require much more data sharing. It's going to require a new set of technologies to enable health systems to be more efficient, to share resources, to make sure that care is happening in the right places. And that shift is really driven by a lot of the CMS changes around reforming how payment happens for various types of things like, you know, bundles and ACOs and that sort of model. And you're saying that with those changes from an incentive perspective, it's not enough just to change the payment models. And that will drag along the infrastructure. We need to do both simultaneously. We need to change the infrastructure as well, make sure that we are set up to for interoperability, and at the same time, have payment reform drive the changes that will require new technology adoption, that will require health systems to share data more, and you know, actually look at all facets of a patient care to reduce costs.
You got it. So let's just make it really simple as an example, Nico. So I'm a primary care physician, patients coming to me, and I need to order an MRI. I could look at my IT system and say, you know what? We are deeply, tightly integrated with the following six neighborhood imaging centers. Some are owned by us, some are friends. And if you push this button, it'll automagically transfer all the relevant information, run the study, and bring the report back in seamless fashion. You're the physician. You see this simplicity, ease of life. You're going to say, boom, let's go to the networks that are connected. Okay? So you're happy. IT did something nice for you. They built some integrations and services, and it reduced the paper back and forth hassle of the past. Well, now let's assume that primary care doctor is responsible for the total cost of care. An important thing in the, along the journey is, I'm going to send this person out for an MRI. What is the best price I can get for my patient in the market? And don't just tell me the six people that I happen to have a direct integration with. Show me all the people in the neighborhood that might be, that have clinical quality outcomes that I respect. They have good history of reading the studies. Maybe I would, it's better for me knowing that it's $1,200 if they stayed in the network, but $300 if they go out of the network. I want to have that same administrative ease to go find the $300 option, because all of a sudden the incentive to me changed. When will that demand signal come? That's the moment we're in right now.
It's almost enabling the provider and the patient to shop and to be consumers rather than to be told where to get care. And I think this is something that, you know, I've had trouble reconciling, you know, in the world of ACOs and the large kind of IDNs of the world. Shopping is almost like they call it leakage, right? When a patient leaves the network and goes elsewhere, they leak out of the network. It's like a cuss word to them, right? It's the worst thing that could happen because patients are seeking care elsewhere, which is a very kind of fundamental consumerism activity. That's the basis behind capitalism, is people shopping and doing what's in their best interest. And the payment reform is starting to make it within the health system's best interest to allow that to happen. And it's reconciling this shopping notion with this leaking notion. And from an economics lens, I think that's really interesting how it's kind of helping to drive that. But yeah, you do need the transparency in order to make that possible. Transparency in price, transparency in quality, convenience for patients to allow a patient to actually be able to shop, or a provider to be able to help a patient shop by saying, yeah, you can get your MRI elsewhere. As long as I can get the data back into my system and we can utilize it for your care, then it's okay.
I do spend a good deal of my time, you know, addressing board of directors or executive teams or industry consortia. And I ask the following question, Nico: are you a supplier or a fiduciary? And the reason for that is embedded in the question you just posed or the scenario that you just shared. So I'm a primary care doctor. I hate to say the word, but generally I'm a supplier of primary care services. So you come to me, I'll do my best to diagnose you or route you or refer you to someone that can help. And I've supplied you a service of my expertise, and you are the beneficiary of it. The fiduciary says, well, wait a minute. I'm going to know everything there is to know about you, including input from the primary care doctor, whose judgment matters a great deal. But I'm also going to look across all these other dimensions. And in looking at all the options, I might want to direct you to do something else, because it's going to be in your best interests, okay? And let me give you the classic, you know, frustration for me. As I mentioned at the outset, one of the things that I worked on in the Obama administration was this $1 billion healthcare innovation challenge, which is to surface ideas that are better care at lower cost. The very first graduate of that investment, that innovation challenge, was the YMCA, and it was their diabetes prevention program. The CMS team under Patrick Conway and Rick Gilfillan, they funded what is essentially a clinical trial with 5,600 patients, pre-diabetics, enrolled them in the $600 YMCA diabetes prevention program course, demonstrated that on average, the patients who were treated in this manner saved taxpayers $2,600, a 4-to-1 return on investment. Based on the evidence, the overwhelming evidence generated by the trial, the actuary of CMS certified that this model should be made available nationwide. And at the end of the Obama administration, Secretary Burwell, and then the beginning of the Trump administration as they transitioned to Secretary Price, doubled down and said, yes, we are going to make this service available nationwide. And in 2018, April to be exact, this service was available nationwide, the $600 voucher to participate in the diabetes program. Nico, at the end of 2018, how many Medicare beneficiaries out of the several hundred thousand that were expected to benefit from this voucher, how many actually signed up for the service?
I'm hoping a lot with the benefits that you described. It seems like an amazing thing. But with patients being engaged in their care the way that they are, I'm imagining you might say a lower number than we would expect.
The number was 202. Now, here's the question. Stage one of meaningful use required that you record effectively the BMI and the A1C levels. So if you were on a stage one meaningful use EHR, every primary care doctor in the country could have run a report that said, show me the list of all patients that would be qualifying for this YMCA $600 voucher, and then written letters to each of those patients to inform them that this is an option. Stage one meaningful use, Nico. How many doctors did that across the country?
Well, in a fee-for-service world, they wouldn't really have much of an incentive to do that, right?
It's not part of the thinking. Like, usually the patient calls you, you schedule the visit, they come in, and you treat them. There's not like this notion of, let me just gauge what's happening across my, you know, however many hundreds of patients panel, and sort of constantly monitor these sorts of opportunities.
They're acting as the supplier, not the fiduciary.
Thank you. So now you ask the question, who's going to be the fiduciary? Now, the political environment we're in right now is trying to position, you know, for those who are opposing the interoperability rules, the argument is some shady Chinese hacker app is going to be a patient's fiduciary. That's the boogeyman, okay? In reality, the fiduciary will more likely than not, Rock Health did the survey, who did patients trust the most with their health data? Physicians. There will be physician apps that will operate as fiduciaries. Or health systems. Even health plans scored like 5x better on trust than big tech. Okay. So the boogeyman in the lobbying against these rules is so laughably wrong that the fundamental is it's going to be someone who's already fighting to earn your trust, who's standing up a division of their service to be your fiduciary. And that's who's going to benefit from these rules in building the services you need. Because that fiduciary app needs to pull the data out of the EHR stage one, needs to run the YMCA eligibility criteria against your numbers, and has to pop out a decision support alert. That future needs interoperability. A fiduciary has to aggregate your data, hopefully run decision support.
What are these new rules that are out there? And I wish they had a better name, because there's this, you know, couple of rules, right? The CMS one, the ONC one, all kind of jolted by the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed a couple of years back now. I've been affectionately calling them meaningful interoperability. But like the set of rules that are in front of us, I'd love you to help explain them. I saw a presentation you did, I think it was in Denver last year, where you probably gave the clearest and most succinct explanation of these new proposed rules. Can you talk our audience through what they are, the spirit of them?
Again, in the spirit of threes, I will try to kind of distill them at its core. Number one, it is a flag in the ground that says the consumer is the bedrock authority that has the right to their information accessible via an application of their choice. Not a little bit of their information, but everything. That's bedrock. Okay. And by the way, bedrock point two is that, oh, by the way, as you standardize data elements and methods for consumers, you can absolutely reuse all of that investment in more traditional B2B or BAA governed traditional healthcare transactions. So it's sort of build consumer first, reuse for contractually negotiated transactions, and you get sort of a two for one on this massive infrastructure upgrade.
And it's putting the patient at the center, or the consumer, I should say, at the center of the data exchange. Because right now, many companies get access to patient data through BAAs, and patients have no idea where their data is going and where it's being stored. So through this new model with the patient at the center, it really allows them to, it's almost more of a GDPR-like approach of the patient has a right to say where their data could and should be used, and a right to say not.
Yeah, well, it's a slightly American version, okay? I'm going to reserve that statement to bullet three, if you don't mind. I want to come back to that. It's an important part of the rules. But as to the technical aspects, I'm going to summarize these as technical, marketplace, and protections. So let's go technical. In that area, we've now said the consumer has the right to the data. So that's a highfalutin word, okay? What does that mean technically? What that really means is any EHR that is certified and any doctor that wishes to participate in the quality program, they have to make the set of information that is sort of standardized for the country to the consumer. Today, that's a small amount of information. It envisions a much larger amount of information.
So there's the core clinical data set, but now we've been talking more about USCDI as kind of a slightly expanded version of that. And that's the data you're talking about, is the small set that we're mandated. And I guess the final rule will determine exactly what that is.
Well, sort of. So that's what I'm going to, the acronyms to the audience may get a little bit confusing. And so I'm going to try to put some context around them, because we're not moving from one acronym to the other per se. The point is, once the flag is in the ground, the technical work is to data map all of the proprietary data sets in the industry, every one of them, convert that to an open data standard, and then transmit that intellectual property free data set wherever that patient chooses. That's what the technical architecture calls for. By the way, CMS is extending that to go beyond EHRs into government-sponsored health plans. So we're going to have claims data and clinical data in an intellectual property-free data set that can be accessible by apps consumers trust. That's the technical statement in these rules, period.
This probably shows where I'm coming from, but that statement just gave me goosebumps.
Now we get to marketplace, okay? Now this is where all the fight is taking place in the regulatory world, in my opinion. I think if you said to me, you know, if I polled the CEOs of every organization that's opposing these rules and I just stopped at number one, I think everybody would say, yes, we're on board. Okay. It's number two where we've got huge divergences of opinion. Okay. First, how quickly are we going to map the entire healthcare record as opposed to the common clinical data set? There's the notion that the government will comment from time to time, ratcheting up the floor. So the floor is going to move from the common clinical data set, which has been static for 10 years, basically, to a USCDI, which will sort of tweak and twist the floor over the next decade and beyond. Now, the pace, this is critical, the pace of that expansion to go to from here we are to the entire health record is now entirely in the hands of the private sector. The more we self-organize to say, I want to reflect tumor progression as a standardized data element in the EHR, we have the power in the private sector to get going on that body of work. And that resulted in the Cancer M-Code initiative to work collaboratively with the private sector to standardize, this is how these dozen or two dozen data elements should reflect the state of cancer care in the healthcare marketplace. Absent industry stepping up and collaborating, the rules saying we're going to have a floor, but we challenge you on the ceiling to run as fast as you can at the pace of consensus. That's point number one, and it is the biggest battle, because there's a provision in the proposed rule that says, long before we get consensus on tumor progression, we want you to take whatever cancer data you've got, notes, whatever, and just dump the raw material in a what's called the EHI export, not standardized, but free of intellectual property limits and exposed to the patient. This, the EHR vendors oppose considerably, at least as I read their filings. Okay. So Nico, under my marketplace concept, the pace of data mapping and intellectual property free data models is a source of tension. Will we move fast or slow? And will the government be the backstop or simply the enabler of a much faster marketplace? That's fight number one. Fight number two is net neutrality. In the telecom wars, the notion that Comcast cable shows up in my home with a fiber connection or Fios or whatever, I'm not necessarily going to be switching between Fios and Comcast all that quickly. I'm kind of locked in to the choice I've made. They've brought the wire to my house, the wire works, information flows. So the net neutrality concept is that if Comcast is the chosen vendor to provide the pipes, they cannot take advantage of that unique role in somehow weakening my ability to watch Netflix because they have a version of Netflix and Comcast called Peacock. So they can't sort of throttle down the user experience so that it's more choppy when I watch Netflix, but it's crystal clear when I watch Peacock. They're not allowed to do any of that stuff. I, as the consumer who pay a fair price for that pipe, have the freedom to choose any app of my choice. That net neutrality regime is the bedrock of the proposed interoperability rules around information blocking. So if you are the pipe, you are the EHR vendor, the infrastructure that probably won't get replaced all that often when you have sunk $1 billion as a system into its implementation. That what we would see here is rules of the road on how they can get paid a fair utility service price for the pipes that they've made available, and that the marketplace not be preferenced in any way based on apps they choose to build natively into their products or substitutable apps that their customers, doctors, patients, nurses, networks want to build on their own. That's bedrock, Nico. And I am highly confident the government's going to come out strongly in favor of net neutrality-like models. That's fight number two. If I'm both an app developer and the pipes, can I preference my apps on my pipes? And what will that look like if I do? I think that's the existential threat to the industry. If you're an electronic health record vendor, you want your app to grow. You want to offer apps for price transparency. You're going to want to offer apps for care coordination, apps for clinical decision support. And now those things that you would otherwise have thought were native to your core product now have to be opened up so that others can compete for things that you naturally believe are your product roadmap. That is a source of stress. And that's why there's a great deal of resistance to that part of the rule. That's fight number two.
These fights, have they already played out? Because we saw the comment period, ONC collected and CMS collected the comments, have taken the feedback and presumably brought that into the final rule that's now out of their hands in the budget assessment, right?
We're in the 2-minute warning of the fourth quarter where the ball can go, you know, it can go any way. If I were in the healthcare sector, thinking about this sort of what's the market dynamics, my bullet number two, what are the rules of the road in this new market environment? I have a fighting chance to claw back some of these concepts, or if you are on my side, if you will, if you were to take sides, that you could err on the side of keeping holding firm on the things that were in the proposed rule. The proposed rule obviously said net neutrality, substitutable apps, you know, no special effort. Very crystal clear. The question is, does all this intense lobbying shift that in any way? I strongly believe that it should not, and it will not.
To give a little review, I think that we talked through some of the context as to how we got to where we are, what's different about our industry, what legislation is coming through right now to correct some of the challenges. And I think looking at the financial industry corollary is really interesting because we had Mint.com, which was kind of the first app that brought consumers into this fintech space and really drove a lot of the demand for the APIs that were eventually created. And, you know, nowadays we have this fintech landscape where there's amazing applications out there that will help people invest and manage their money and budget better and all that sort of stuff. What I think we might be missing, though, is where is the consumer health tech equivalent of Mint.com? Not from a functionality standpoint, but from a user demand. the future holds this landscape, this infrastructure that will allow that to exist, but we're still kind of waiting on that, right? Like we kind of need the entrepreneurs of the world to create these applications such that consumers will pull their data out and demand it from their providers and medical records and be able to enable this fiduciary responsibility for from their providers and heck from themselves as actual consumers directing their own care. Are we missing that?
The answer to your question is yes and no. CMS has been operating an app store a la mint.com for over a year, since August of 2018. There are roughly 40 plus app developers that have been certified and are approved so consumers can access their information. And by the way, for all the boogeyman talk of shady Chinese hacker apps, there is not a single Chinese hacker app on the CMS app store. They are apps built by Humana, by Rush, by Verily, by startups that are focused on, you know, PHRs. So Nico, to some degree, if you want a window into the future, look at the CMS Blue Button App Store to get a flavor of what are the apps offering consumers that's different than what they can get from their patient portal, mymedicare.gov. That's a healthy area of debate. Why I say yes and no, meaning no, it is already, we're getting a window of it right now in production. On the yes side, in terms of we're waiting for something, there's a huge data governance question in front of the health systems and health plans that are going to be subject to this rule. And you'll bear with me for a moment, Nico, on this one, because I do think it's the heart of the issue. Today, any of these organizations can meet the letter of the proposed rules by simply outsourcing to their existing EHR vendor or their claims data vendor the task of opening up a kind of an API portal for apps as opposed to humans to log in and access the data. And so the simplest thing you could do as a health system is to simply say, hey, vendors, turn this thing on and make sure that we're compliant. But remember the second thing I said to you, which is that, oh, by the way, if you're going to make all of this investment for consumer apps, reuse it for your more traditional B2B applications, the stuff that you live with every day, sending ADT notifications to doctors, thinking about clinical quality registries, preparing for care coordination and other price transparency initiatives. So if you're going to think about reusability, why would you only allow consumers access to this information? Why wouldn't you establish your own governance framework that says, by the way, we want to make this available to our clinical registries and care coordinators and everything else. To do that, I believe either the EHR vendors have to give full control on which apps are in which app store and under what economic terms to their customer, which is not the marketplace I see unfolding, or health systems have to decouple their API gateways from their legacy EHR vendors. By the way, Nico, this could be the role for Redox, and I don't want to speak for your business or anyone else, but it's an opportunity to say, how can we provide the kind of infrastructure support that allows the reuse of this patient compliance API requirement into more ubiquitous utility service that feeds all the interoperability use cases that go far beyond just the consumer? Because once you've converted the data from proprietary to open data model, you'd want to share that with lots of partners, obviously by contract and obviously by negotiation, not Chinese hacker apps that you're going to spam on the internet. So regulated BAAs, use cases. So I think what we need, and I think what we saw in the financial services industry, is that organizations began decoupling their back-end financial systems of record from their data aggregation sort of API layers. And some did that under the hood. That is to say, they had control over that inside their own infrastructure. And others simply worked with aggregators like Plaid and others to do it on the other side to say, look, we're going to allow you, Plaid, to be that network developer. And then if people want to build apps and come through, they can, instead of talking to me every single, you know, I don't want to talk to 100 apps, talk to one. And then, and that became effectively like a quasi app store for the banking industry. So there may be a number of emerging business models that will come up. But the fundamental question is, are organizations taking a compliance mindset or a data governance, reusability, interoperability mindset. And if they take the latter, I don't really see many other choices but to decouple and to have, hopefully, a competitive marketplace of tools and services that could facilitate the reuse of this regulated open data set for more than just the consumer use case.
You've painted a picture of a future that is quite optimistic, really. You know, there's a lot going on in our economy and our politics and in healthcare that can kind of bring some gloom. But the light at the end of the tunnel of interoperability, I think, is coming upon us. And the way that you've described it, I think, really brings a lot of optimism to what we should be able to expect, not only from the industry, but from entrants in the industry, technology providers, people who will give data to the right people at the right time to ensure that care happens for patients at, you know, a much lower cost than is the burden that we experience today. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk this through with us, because I know it's a complex topic that, you know, hard to understand. And you have a brilliant way of making it clear. And so, you know, Anish, I know you ran for office at some point in the past. When are we going to see that again? And when can I vote for you about on something?
You're very kind. I did, for the history folks, I left the White House in order to run for Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. I do believe that this public-private interface is sort of an opportunity for effectiveness and efficiency across health, energy, education, financial services, and the like. So I'm passionate. And let's get healthcare right, Nico. Let's work together to make this better. And who knows what the future holds. But I'll leave you with this one final thought. I know we're running near to the end of our discussion, but it's central around this concept of policy and where we're heading. The one area that we didn't cover in depth, but I would be remiss to say we have to, is that there needs to be clear rules of the road on internet privacy. And as you might recall, during my time in the Obama administration, we did publish an Internet Privacy Bill of Rights. Now, Congress did not vote on that proposal, but I think the timing is getting better and better by the day. And we, in the private sector of healthcare, we have the opportunity to self-organize. I do co-chair the Karen Alliance with Governor Leavitt, with a multi-stakeholder group of people from the tech community to the patient advocacy groups to the EHR systems and the health plans and the integrated networks. And the goal is to kind of fill in the gaps that in this future where consumers have control over their data, they're moving the data from a HIPAA-covered asset to an unprotected asset. But we can solve for that by making sure that there is protection. And the Karen Code of Conduct is the one that I'm pushing the hardest and would welcome any feedback and advice on making it better and stronger. And we also have to strengthen HIPAA. Today, in the Google Ascension debate around, the Atlantic said it best, it was Google's totally legal, totally creepy, something, 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 you know, case study. It is an area where we've got to acknowledge that today, healthcare data, once de-identified, is sold every single step of the way. You know, the very attacks about consumers having control and apps acting poorly is really a pox on all our houses, because the very organizations that are arguing we should stop enabling consumers to choose those apps because they're unprotected are the very same organizations, in most cases, who actually sell patient data once it's been de-identified. So, Nico, you asked me about running for office, but I think we can solve policy problems together without changing sort of who's in charge, because our unique American philosophy is that industries can self-organize, we can self-regulate, and if we don't do a good job, government can step in and backstop us. So privacy is an area where we absolutely have to do more, and I hope with this podcast and those who are listening don't just take the technology aspects of it away, but an opportunity to raise their hands and participate in a more privacy-protecting regime as we move to the modern era of healthcare data interoperability.
Well, I'm right there with you. Both my hands are raised. Let's go do this. Thank you so much for going through this with me. And, you know, in this hour conversation we've had, we've really kind of touched the surface of a lot of these issues. And, you know, you mentioned the Karen Alliance and the Code of Conduct there. What are other resources that people should look at to dive deeper into this, to learn more, other places where they can really start to understand more about HIPAA or more about the legislation or many of the topics that we've talked about today?
Yeah, generally speaking, the Office of Civil Rights in HHS has done a phenomenal job in the past 2 years clarifying what the HIPAA right of action means, right of access means, and the presumption that the debate we're having technically about how a consumer connects an app to their data is simply a technical advancement on a bedrock law that's been in HIPAA since its origins. So the Office of Civil Rights website, the Frequently Asked Questions section, wonderful resource to learn about what is or is not already part of HIPAA. Part two, on the technical standards side, I'm very proud of the HL7 standards body, which is the body that governs the Fire API. I think Graham Grieve, who's my hero, our country's hero, our global hero, frankly, he's an Australian by birth, was really put in place as sort of a fast tracking of technical standards consensus making. And so the Argonaut project is an example of how the EHR vendors are building on Fire and running faster together. The DaVinci project is where the plans are coming together on administrative transactions. The Karen Alliance is working on health plan claims on Fire. And then a number of other, social determinants of health, the Gravity Project, the cancer data with M-Code. So the HL7 Fire accelerators as a concept and all the respective names and acronyms I just threw out there are all wonderful resources. And then the Karen Alliance, which is KarenAlliance.com, has a published code of conduct that was published in May of 2019. And it gives you exhaustive detail of that GDPR-like model that can be organized in the industry self-regulatory domain and to have the FTC and state attorneys general capable of holding people's feet to the fire if they agree to participate in that code. So those are the three areas. Go to the government on the rights, go to the technical standards under HL7, and then the sort of privacy and policy issues to the Karen Alliance. Nico, those would be my three recommendations up front.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time again. And of course, we'll be looking out for you as the industry continues to evolve based on a lot of the leadership that you put in place as well as advocate for now in your private sector role. So I appreciate your service.
My pleasure. Take care, Nico. Happy to follow up anytime.
Hey everyone, it's Nico here again. Wanted to drop another thank you to Anish Chopra for that fascinating conversation today. If you haven't already, subscribe to the Redox podcast wherever you get your podcasts, because you won't want to miss our next interview with Matt Fisher, who of course puts the hip in HIPAA. He is a privacy specialist focusing on the healthcare space, and we have a really fascinating conversation about what happens to your data after it gets digitized in the EHR and beyond. So definitely check that out. Matt is also a HIMSS influencer, and with HIMSS just a month away, we get to discuss a little bit about what goes on there and what it means to be a HIMSS influencer. And of course, I'd love to invite you to the party that we throw every year at HIMSS. We throw it on Monday night. This year's going to be really big. We have a few great partners that we'll be throwing it with. So head on over to redoxengine.com/HIMSS20 for all the information about the event and where you can find us at HIMSS. So hopefully we'll see you there. And if not, we'll catch you next time on the Redox podcast. Thanks a lot.